Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa criticizes travel ban due to COVID Omicron variant.
The prohibition of travel is not informed by science, nor will it be effective in preventing the spread of this variant. The only thing the prohibition on travel will do is to further damage the economies of the affected countries.
Officials dismiss report Uganda could lose its international airport to China. Eswatini civil society groups get invited to South Africa to discuss their country's future. Sudan's military leader visits border with Ethiopia amid reports of Ethiopian incursion. Guinean President Alpha Conde has been relocated to the residence of his wife. And Botswana's government loses an attempt to overturn homosexuality ruling.
It is indeed a great victory for the nation, for the lovers of human rights, for my clients, but it is a decision of our highest court which will reverberate around the world.
And protesters call for Burkina Faso's president to resign. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Despite criticism of Western nations for banning travel from Southern Africa over the new Omicron variant, countries in Africa are beginning to take similar steps. Morocco and Rwanda are the latest to ban flights to ward off the new variant, which was first reported in South Africa. Health experts have been quick to dismiss the ban and say countries should instead focus on getting their populations vaccinated. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
Britain, the European Union, the US and some African countries have imposed bans of flights from South Africa and several neighbouring countries. South African officials quickly denounced the new restrictions. Speaking Sunday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the travel ban would hinder his country's ability to fight the new variant.
The prohibition of travel is not informed by science, nor will it be effective in preventing the spread of this variant. The only thing the prohibition on travel will do is to further damage the economies of the affected countries and undermine their ability to respond to and also to recover from the pandemic.
Last week, South Africa detected a new COVID variant that is believed to be highly transmittable and vaccine-resistant. The variant Omicron has been reported in several other countries. Catherine Kaktunji is the head of the African Population and Health Research Center. She says scientists are working to see whether the coronavirus variant Omicron is more dangerous than the Delta variant, the most contagious form of coronavirus that has spread worldwide.
Delta, it's estimated that for every case, it's able to infect between 5 and 8. For the original variant was about between 2 and 3. So if this is more transmissible, then it means more trouble, really, for the world and for Africa. Now, the second thing they're trying to find out is if it causes either different symptoms or causes more severe disease. So if it's more transmissible, causes more severe disease, it means that the world is in for a rough ride because more epidemics, more outbreaks, more waves that are more severe.
Health experts warn the world faces more trouble if the COVID-19 vaccines cannot help fight the new variant. However, the World Health Organization has warned against imposing a travel ban on countries and instead called for taking a scientific approach in dealing with the outbreak. Chibuzo Opara is the head of DrugsTalk, an African cloud-based platform that improves access to pharmaceutical and healthcare products. He says African countries will need to revive the previous health measures taken to combat the spread of the coronavirus.
I think the most important thing is sharing of information. I think we need to look to the ports of entries to improve surveillance and monitoring. I think it's very important to also step up the vaccination campaigns, the travel requirements for screening should also be harmonized, and it should be. I think we can easily step up those without necessarily harming the economy or a lot of the infrastructure that was there during the pandemic and into this period is still around and can be ramped up really easily.
Some experts also warn new lockdown measures could be needed to prevent transmission of Omicron. So far, South Africa has refrained from taking that kind of step. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Sudanese military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan visited forces stationed along the border with Ethiopia. The visit comes after Sudan's army alleged that several soldiers were killed by Ethiopian army and its proxy militias over the weekend. Michael Ati has more for VOA from Khartoum.
General al-Burhan and other senior Sudanese military officials arrived in the El Fashaga border area. Sudan Armed Forces issued a statement and posted on its official Facebook page over the weekend, accusing Ethiopia of killing its soldiers during a confrontation between the Sudan Armed Forces and Ethiopian militias at El Fashaga. The statement says the Sudanese troops were working to secure the harvest in El Fashaga and were attacked by groups of Ethiopian army and militias who sought to intimidate farmers and spoil the harvest season. The army said the Sudanese troops repelled the attackers and caused heavy losses in lives and equipment. The statement said the attack left several killed among Sudanese forces but did not give the exact death toll. Al-Burhan's media and information advisor, General At-Tahir Abu Haja, says the Sudanese military leader is in Al-Fashaga to inspect the border and boost the morale of the soldiers at the border. He says Ethiopia shall always remain a good neighbor to Sudan, and any isolated incidents can never drag the two nations into war.
All we want is that,
Abu Haja says, all we want is to maintain our borders and to depend on a genuine dialogue in resolving disputes over Al-Fashaga and other areas with the neighboring Ethiopia. We don't like war, and we do respect our neighboring countries, Abu Haja says. The Ethiopian government on Sunday denied that its forces were involved in the incident. The French news agency AFP reports the Addis Ababa government instead blamed fighters from the rebel Tigray People's Liberation Front. Abdul Munem Abu Idris is a political analyst and Sudanese journalist who is also an expert on the Horn of Africa. He says the recent escalation of violence at the border could create insecurity and humanitarian crisis. He says the weekend's fighting might have been triggered by the Ethiopian militia in the Amhara region. Abu Idris says he believes the situation in the two countries now is not conducive for any military confrontations between the two countries.
The situation in the two countries does not give a chance for any one of them to do such a thing. Ethiopia is busy by her interior fighting. Sudan is busy by his political and economic crisis.
Abu Idris says the Horn of Africa is restive with conflicts in Somalia and Ethiopia, adding that any confrontations between member countries would create more insecurity and economic problems. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
In Eswatini, pro-democracy activists, civil society groups, political parties, and other major stakeholders have been invited to meet in South Africa about their demands for democratic reforms in the Southern African country. Organized by the Leftu Sonke Institute of Strategic Thinking and Development, the aim is to develop a common platform to ensure their demands are met. Matla Lashwayo is the chairperson of Leftu Sonke Institute of Strategic Thinking and Development. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the administration in Mbabane must embrace change, including reforms demanded by citizens of the kingdom.
These are meetings which will bring all the major stakeholders in Swaziland, led by all the political parties. It is an effort by Swazis to sit down and reflect on what's going on in Swaziland and begin to put together the basis for dialogue, if dialogue will be taking place.
What is the core objective of this? Is the core objective to start the process to pressure the administration in Mbabane for more democratic reforms?
The core objective is to basically emerge with a common vision of the Swaziland that everybody is fighting for, so that if the process of dialogue does progress, there is a common basis by everybody who is in the space that is articulating and agitating for change that will be all agreed upon. It is also to ensure that the Swazi democracy movement is not basically blindsided and only looking at dialogue. They are also able to look at other scenarios that the government in Swaziland and the king is actually forced to accept the will of the people of Swaziland.
But if this happens, wouldn't this play into the hands of supporters of the king and perhaps the government that says that institutions like yours are trying to create problems in the country by fomenting trouble and creating instability, encouraging these pro-democracy activists to act like terrorists, fight the security operatives in the country?
Over the past 50 years, people have seen their lives being wasted. All that they've seen being achieved is a very wealthy monarch that owns 60% of the economy. If people are basically rolling their sleeves and saying enough is enough with this, this is our country, these are our resources, it's actually time that we actually claim back what belongs to the people. If people stand up and say that, no one who is genuinely respective of their plight and their conditions can actually claim that these people are terrorists.
Matla Lashwayo is the chairperson of Leftu Sonke Institute of Strategic Thinking and Development. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 30th. Botswana's government has lost a bid to overturn a 2019 court ruling that decriminalized same-sex relations. Human rights groups have welcomed the decision, saying it opens the door to challenge what they say are other discriminatory laws in Botswana. Umkandisi Dube reports from Habaruni.
The five judges on Botswana's Court of Appeal were unanimous in upholding the June 29 landmark decision, which recognized homosexuality. Court of Appeal President Ian Kepi says criminalizing same-sex activities violates the constitutional right of lesbians, gays, bisexual and transgender persons. He says the offending sections of the penal code have outlived their usefulness and only serve to encourage law enforcement agents to become keyhole peepers and intrude into the private space of citizens. The government wanted the 2019 court ruling overturned, arguing the majority of people in the country did not agree with it. Representing the LGBTQ community, lawyer Tia Morantao says the matter has finally been laid to rest.
It is indeed a great victory for the nation, for the lovers of human rights, for my clients, but it is a decision of our highest court which will reverberate around the world. It will not have any impact only in Botswana, but all over the world, because you see, the issues that were before it are not our just local, they're universal issues. So it is, as I say, a victory that will live with us as a nation for many, many years to come.
Lesbians, gays and bisexuals of Botswana or Lekakipo Chief Executive Thato Moruti says the development will add impetus to advocacy on human rights issues.
What is quite interesting and what is quite evident is that Botswana needs to realize even more the importance of adhering or understanding human rights first. And specifically to today's judgment, I'm quite excited because I believe that this judgment has not only challenged us as a people in Botswana, but it has also challenged leadership in Botswana from an engagement perspective, even from a policy standpoint.
Moruti says the judgment will spare them to challenge what they say are other discriminatory sections of Botswana's laws.
We are continuing with the war, and you know, from an organization standpoint, there are legislations or litigation opportunities that we've identified, and we are working round the clock to ensure that after this we look at what is next.
The Southern African Litigation Center Executive Director Anna Mulai Chalmers says the court victory is not just for the LGBTQ community, but all vulnerable groups.
But what it does as well is giving the activists the tool to talk to the public around changing public opinion, to talk to traditional leaders and religious leaders as such. So, yeah, there are a lot of human rights clauses there that also talks to persons with disabilities to use the case, because it's not just for LGBT, it's for a whole vulnerable communities.
Under the previous law, those caught engaging in same-sex activities faced up to 7 years in imprisonment. Homosexuality remains forbidden in most African countries. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Haboroni.
Ugandan officials are rejecting reports that China could take control of the country's only international airport because of a failure to honor a loan agreement. China's embassy in Uganda also dismissed the report, but analysts note the loan deal could become a problem if Uganda ever has trouble paying it back. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Local media reports had indicated that Uganda risked losing its only international airport to China over a $200 million loan to expand the facility. According to documents shared with local media, China rejected Uganda's request to renegotiate some clauses in the 2015 loan deal. This included a clause that required Uganda's Civil Aviation Authority to set up an escrow account to hold all of its revenues. Under the clause, the revenues in this account cannot be spent by the Aviation Authority without approval from Beijing. Vianney Luja, the Uganda Civil Aviation Authority spokesperson, told VOA that the Ugandan government has no intention of defaulting on loan repayments to China.
It is not true that Uganda is going to lose the entire international airport in any way whatsoever. This is not the first time that this allegation is coming up. Uganda is not about to default in honoring the loan obligations. We are still within a grace period of 7 years, and during that period, we have been paying interest.
The loan agreement also gives China's Export-Import Bank oversight over monthly operating budgets for the airport. The bank is also authorized to inspect both the Aviation Authority and Ugandan government books of accounts, which some see as eroding the sovereignty of the state. When VOA contacted the Chinese embassy in Uganda, they say they were not in position to comment and referred VOA to a statement they issued Sunday. In the statement, the embassy said the loan agreement between China Exim Bank and Uganda was signed voluntarily through dialogue and negotiation on equal footing without any hidden terms or political conditions attached. They said China-Uganda economic and trade cooperation and financing in the field of large-scale infrastructure follows the principle of equality and mutual benefit and has been conducted in accordance with the laws and rules of the international market and strictly abided by the laws of the host country. Economic analyst Fred Muhumze explains that technically any loan received from an Exim Bank is not treated as a loan but as an export, thus making it difficult to renegotiate. Muhumze says it is time for the government and its lawyers to re-examine how it handles its agreements with donors.
These loans are reviewed by Solicitor General's office, who are the lawyers. It also indicates in case of arbitration, we go to China. So you really are the mass of China. They have an upper hand on this.
Uganda currently owes China $1.6 billion in loans extended to the East African country for financing of major infrastructure development projects. In a 2018 report, Uganda's Auditor General raised concern that Uganda had agreed to several stringent conditions in the loans, and these had not only increased the cost of borrowing, but also exposed Uganda's sovereignty to risk. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Former Guinean President Alpha Conde has been relocated from the Palace of the People, where he has been held since his overthrow in September this year, to his wife's residence somewhere in the capital, Conakry. Fayami Limuno, the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea, says this was a gesture by the military junta ahead of the December 12 Economic Community of West African States ECOWAS summit. Conde's freedom was one of ECOWAS's demands, in addition to pressing the military junta to hold elections in 6 months. However, Milimuno says the relocation should not be misconstrued as total freedom for Mr. Conde.
The latest in Guinea here is the transfer of the former president, who was held at Mohamed Senk Palace, where the current transitional period president is living. So he was transferred to the residence of the former first lady. So that just happened today. And I think it is in accordance with the COVID's requirement to free Alpha Conde.
Does that mean now that the former president is on the road to being released or freed?
It won't be so easy, I will say. It won't be so easy. He's been removed to his wife's residence, but from my understanding, I don't think we can talk about him to be released very soon because of what happened during the 12 years in our country.
In terms of the transition to democratic process, because ECOWAS wants the military junta or the transitional administration there to come up with a timetable, is there any movement on that?
Not yet. I mean, to talk about the timetable, we have to wait until the legislative body of the transitional is put in place, what we call CNP. People have presented the candidates. It is now the responsibility of the Minister of Territorial Affairs to select the 81 people to be on board of the CNT.
What can you tell us about this report that a delegation from the International Criminal Court has visited Guinea? What can you tell us about why they were there?
Oh, they were here because nothing has been done since the massacre happened in 2009, on September the 28th. Remember, 157 were killed that same day, and many women were raped in the stadium. So it's been 12 years since that happened, and not justice. So the international community came to express the concern and to recommend the Kenyan authorities, you know, to take action about it.
The interim justice minister, Fatoumata Suma, has given some assurance that this trial will take place.
Yeah, that is what she said. But remember, for the last 12 years, all the minister of justice, they have just said the same thing. We hope this time is going to be different, because in any country that, where there is no justice, it's difficult to fight crimes. In Guinea, so many people have lost their lives. So if we continue with the same thing, people are killed, nothing is done, it encourages the criminals to continue doing just what they're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Fayemi Limuno is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. Security is worsening in Burkina Faso with the deadliest attacks by Islamist militants in the West African country in years on civilians and security forces. People are protesting the failure of Burkinabe and international forces to stop the violence, with some calling for change at the top. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
Downtown Ouagadougou, early Saturday, police fired tear gas into crowds of protesters calling for the resignation of Burkina Faso's president, Roch Kabore. Journalists were hit with tear gas too, even after identifying themselves as press. One local radio journalist was injured after being hit in the face with a tear gas canister. In recent days, protests have spread across cities in Burkina Faso. Demonstrators were angry at what they say is the government's inability to counter terrorism after an Al-Qaeda-linked terror group attacked a military outpost in the north of the country, killing at least 50 military police. Mamadou Drabo is a protest leader. He says we want the departure of Roch by noon. We want the resignation of Roch, his government, and the MPP regime. By early Saturday, the police had blocked entrances to the square where protesters were due to meet. Some protesters began shouting at military police. Others approached them with their hands up to show their support for the security forces. Not all demonstrations were peaceful, however. Some attacked a pickup truck carrying members of a local militia known as the Kogluiegos. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
And that's it for this Tuesday, November 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a lovely day.